Log Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. And Audrey, you are here tonight, and Mike Sorrento is here tonight, and Lucy's off again. She's on a kayaking trip. Can you believe that? So that means I'm confronted with the task of coming up with a blonde joke that will be worthy of her skill in finding such jokes, and I'm a little worried about this joke tonight, but anyway, we'll wait till we get to that point. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and this is the Jumble Justice Radio Show. If you've never heard it before, we've been around since 2006 or 2007 and done lots of shows, at least probably 45 a year, something like that. Once in a while, we take a day off. Based on circumstances. But anyway, I'm glad that you can join us tonight. And we're off on an interesting show tonight. You know, we kind of hover around police and criminal justice, and that's why the show is called Jumble Justice. But our show tonight is very interesting. I think you'll enjoy it. It's the news reporter Graham Raymond. And he wrote a book called The New York PD Tapes, NYPD Tapes, A Shocking Story of Cops' Cover-Ups and Courage. So anyway, he'll tell you about it, but he has New York cops that actually audiotaped all kinds of things. And then he's collected all this and put it together in book form. So it's an interesting book. And I want to point out something ahead of time. I mean, people, I think, police, when they do wrong and bad, need to be disciplined. They need to be sent to jail, and some of them do. But on the other hand, you got to remember, we have nearly a million police in the United States and 18,000 different law enforcement agencies. And over 50% of those, by the way, have 10 officers or less, and they do their job. And when we're in trouble, even those people that criticize the police, what do? They call the police, right? Yeah. You know what I mean. So anyway, we try to look inside the life of professional criminal justice agents on this show, and we've done it for a long time, and I hope you'll enjoy our show tonight. We want to thank Alan Libby, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Blog Talk Radio, and this is the place where you, your organization, your interest group, can come up with a radio show and be online in literally probably less than 10 minutes, and then you can broadcast the show as often as you want. There are some limited times. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. Would somebody believe that 10 years ago? It's still just remarkable to me. My show and all the other shows are archived immediately for replay or download. A lot of people don't listen to our show live. They pick it up at their convenience. And so you can go to Blog Talk Radio site and get that also. All right. So tonight's show, I already told you what that's going to be about. And if we have time, you can actually call in on 347-996-5983 and comment on the show. We're going to be pretty tight tonight with the new shows and this story. Graham Raymond's going to take about 47 minutes to get his story across, and I think you'll find it very, very interesting. So we have a blonde joke tonight, and I picked this this joke out. And I think people will like this joke. I assume they will. So let's kind of give it a try and see what we can find out. This joke is this. How do you drown a bond? Oh, that's an awful question. How do you drown a bond? You put a mirror in the bottom of a swimming pool. Oh, I agree. That's a bad joke, but some will laugh at it. We have no malintentions when we do blonde jokes, and you know that. Okay. The Haya Coalition, by the way, would like you to pay attention to this business about carrying guns, and that's certainly been an issue this week with the terrible, tragic shooting event at the Naval Yard in Washington, D.C. But the Haya Coalition would like for you criminals to hear this public service announcement and go turn in your firearms, give them over to the police. Here it is.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Okay, we also have a green tip tonight, as always. And this green tip tonight comes from Esma Floyd's little book called 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. The planet savers are in a little bit of trouble, if you notice the last couple weeks, because it seems like there is voluminous amounts of research showing that not only is the planet not getting warmer, it's cooler than it's been like in 50 years. And by now, according to Al Gore, we have like 7 inches or whatever of ice all over, or the ice would all be melting. And now we've got, you know, a foot or so of ice all over the ice caps and all kinds of things, and the temperature's down and everything else. So sorry, Al, but will you turn in the billions of dollars that you've made convincing people that the planet's going to disappear and melt? I don't think he will. Not one of my favorite guys, I must admit that, based on this climatology and all this craziness. But anyway, here's the green tip, and this one is real. People like birds. Do you know any bird watchers? I've only known a couple in my life, and boy, do they get into it. I mean, I forget how many thousands of species and types of birds and that type of thing. But here's the green tip. In the summer months, it can be hard for birds to find water to drink and wash in. As well as leaving them food, make sure that you leave some water as well. A lot of people feed the birds. You know, I throw McDonald's chicken McNuggets out for the birds once in a while when I eat in a parking lot and listen to the radio. But anyway, give them something to drink also, because in the summertime particularly, we're closing out of summer, it's a very difficult fact. Is today the first day of fall? No, that's the 21st, right, or 22nd, what are they calling that now? This is a full moon day, though, so if I'm a little confused in doing the show, you'll know why. The full moon, I can feel it. I used to run all these marathons, I've told you that before, dozens and dozens and dozens, full length, etc., ultra distances, and my worst times were always on full moon days, and I never looked ahead of time to find out. Anyway, well, maybe a couple times I did. But isn't that weird? Really weird. Well, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news tonight, and there's a lot of things going on. I'd like to comment on the shooting in Washington, D.C., but it's voluminous. That's a whole show. In fact, we might do a whole show on that here in the future. But I do want to say a couple of things. It is very troubling to find out from a number of very reliable sources that there were, I think the Washington, D.C. police response team, I think it was their SWAT team, got there, could have been there in like 3 minutes or 7 minutes or something like that. But the Capitol Hill police, they were there. I've got an article about this. They were there in a very short period of time, within like 3 minutes, and they were told to stand down. Isn't that interesting? They were actually told that they should stand down, and they were literally 3 minutes from this place. And they were 30 seconds from the gate, and 13 people, lost their lives in this event as this nutbag, I assume he was a nutbag, brought his AR-15, wrong, it wasn't an AR-15, I still can't believe that. All the misconceptions about what kind of weapon he was carrying. He was carrying a shotgun, but I think he bought, was it, I don't know where, I won't say where he bought it, but somewhere he legally bought. Then the other thing that's weird about this, and I'm only going to make a couple points, nobody on that property was allowed to have guns. And you know, if there were 6, 7, 10, 12 people in that whole area where he came in and shot these people up, if 3 or 4 of those people would have responded with a firearm, somebody would have hit him and saved lives. And they don't allow firearms, any concealed carry or open carry. I don't think open carry people were even around. I've been on bases, guys walking around with 45s, you know, loaded on their, lots of times. That was back in the Ice Age, and nobody shot anybody. But anyway, the same thing, it's weird that he wasn't allowed to do that. The other thing is, the background check on this guy. You've heard about his background, a couple of arrests. He was in a mental hospital overnight or in an emergency room, saying that people were talking to him and talking to him through the walls and all that kind of stuff. And this guy had a top secret security clearance. And this record goes back 10 or 15 years. How in the world can that be? Why in the world would we need this nutbag? And I will say that. To be working on a base as a contract person. And he was given, I've seen two different accounts of this, and the news stories will clear up and get closer to the truth the longer we get from the event. But he was given a general discharge from the Navy Reserve, and then I saw somebody else say he was given an honorable. I think after a while, if you don't get in trouble, generals might turn into honorable discharge. But most people get out and get an honorable discharge. And he had lots of discipline cases in the Army, not showing up at the time, being in the wrong place, all kinds of, or Navy, excuse me, all kinds of things. But can you actually believe that? Here's an energy-saving tip. Ford is coming out with a new police car that's going to save 2 or 3 miles per gallon in the city and 2 or 3 miles per gallon on the highway. It'll go 32 on the highway instead of 30. And it'll be 23 in the city instead of 20. Now, isn't that breaking news? So that will involve some measures of saving the planet by getting a Ford Taurus that's called, what's it called, the Echo Cruiser or something like that. Echo Boost engine. I've never had a Echo engine in any cars I've owned. Harley Davidsons, have they got those yet? Mike, that's who we ought to have an Echo engine for, so we could stop hearing blah, blah, blah. I hate that, sitting beside somebody on a Harley Davidson. Anyway, would you believe that LA Times found out that a projected $650 million in welfare benefits will be distributed to illegal alien parents in 2013? That's what the county officials said. The supervisor, Michael Antonovich, announced this latest figure from the Department of Public Social Services, which showed that more than $376 million in CalWORKs benefits and food stamps combined have been distributed through July to illegal alien parents for their native-born children. And you found out in the news this week, I won't go into that one, where people are buying all kinds of stuff with their food stamps. They're not supposed to purchase all these things. They're buying alcohol with their food stamps. I don't get it. But they estimate in Los Angeles there's 100,000 children of 60,000 undocumented parents in the United States. Of course, if those children were born here, they are U.S. citizens. But I don't think we'll ever conquer, I hate to say it, we'll ever conquer this illegal immigration thing. I don't think the will is there, except from that extreme nutty side, the right and conservatives, of which I will join, have joined. But I don't think there's a will to do it, the majority of people in the United States. It's too complex to understand to start with. Unless you've seen a list of all the different things of how this hurts, go to immigrationcounters.com and keep track of it. I've told you to go there before, immigrationcounters.com, and see what's going on. All right, this next news story, should I do it, Mike? Audrey says yes, so I will. We now have national football players. Remember them, the guys that push people around for hundreds and thousands and millions of dollars a year? This is a promotion. NFL players often get involved in that. But four NFL linemen have signed up to help a small Venice, California company crack a new market. And that new market is moistened toilet paper targeted at men. In other words, it's a toilet paper, I guess it's sexist, it's only for men. Isn't it interesting? The sector, this is only 3% of the $8.7 billion toilet paper category. It's usually aimed at infants and toddlers, but the four burly centers, these are linemen, centers I guess, are hoping to change that with a product, cheekily called One Wipe Charlies. The players, I won't even name them, Dallas Cowboys, Minnesota Vikings, they come from their San Diego Chargers and Buffalo Bills, will be kicking off this campaign in 2 weeks. And you notice how toilet paper ads have got a little weird lately anyway, is it Charmin or whatever, where they come out the door and the cartoon character looks at the rear end of the other and says, oh, you did a clean job or something, words of that effect. But the survey conducted by Dollar Shave found that 89% of these wipe users were very satisfied with the cleanliness of their, I won't say it, after using a wipe, versus only 58% for traditional toilet paper. So we're going to see a substantial climb, a 31% climb in satisfaction by using the wet wipes. And one guy says he's been using them for years, and he said it's an enjoyable experience. Not exactly sure what he means by that, but financially, these players are far from cleaning up of the deal. They're likely pocketing only about $10,000 for the piece for this ad campaign. But is that weird or what? I mean, give me something else. By the way, did you know Obamacare will now require doctors to ask questions about your sex life and your sex partners? One of the questions is required, are you sexually active? If so, with one partner, multiple partners, or same-sex partners? And there's a cardiologist on here, Dr. Budzikowski. He's called the sex questions insensitive, stupid, and very intrusive. So now when this Obamacare Affordable Health Care Act, goes into play in October 1, I think the curtain goes up on most of it, except for the people that got exemptions. All this data is going to be collected, and I'm telling you, you won't have anything that's private. But isn't that just incredible? Now, what else? I think they ought to have things on there, the length of your toenails and that type of thing, whether or not you're trimming your nails. I mean, that would be a good idea. For those of you who have been using the Internet for a long period of time, did you know that terrorists, and this is verified by Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA, and he says that terrorists prefer Gmail. It's the most useful to them. I mean, they can get into all kinds of other stuff by using Gmail. the search facilities and tracking and all that. So I know a lot of people here, some here recently, that have gotten off of Gmail. I mean, it's a wonderful service. It stacks them, it sorts it, it finds stuff for you and all that stuff. But some people are saying they don't want to do Gmail anymore. And, you know, you can buy these services for like $25 a year, $30, whatever, where they promise not to shed any light on what you're doing and all that stuff. But, you know, just assume that anything you put on the Internet is like putting it up on a billboard and people are watching it. So, anyway, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this business. So the privacy issue is never going to be over. It's a balanced kind of thing between order and liberty. I mean, we want protection, we want security, but we don't want to give up all of our liberty. But you know, some people, in fact, this article I'm looking at and others have said, forget it, there's not going to be any. So we're moving toward a society where anonymity is absolutely impossible and should not be, they're saying. I don't want to live in that society. How about you? All right, that's it. Let's go ahead and have a listen to the NYPD tapes, and the commentator reporter will be Graham Raymond. Give me a few seconds here to get this thing set up. I think you'll enjoy this.
It appears that crime is declining in the city. After he was found out, Mr. Schoolcraft's superiors had him involuntarily committed to a psych ward for 6 days, claiming that he was emotionally disturbed. This is about 45 minutes.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for coming. I really appreciate it. I've been covering the police department for almost 20 years, and this is the craziest story that I ever came across in my entire period. The book, again, the book is about a police officer secretly recording his police commanders ordering various types of misconduct in Bedford Stuyvesant, the 81st Precinct. The backdrop is the NYPD's crime-fighting strategy known as CompStat. This is a strategy where statistics are used to identify crime hotspots, and then officers are sent to respond to those hotspots. That strategy is credited with the sharp crime drop in the city over the last 20 years. But it had some weaknesses that became more and more apparent as time went on. And that sort of numbers-oriented strategy had some problems because it inspired commanders to come up with the ways to make crime look better without actually, you know, ways to make crime look like it was going down without actually doing the work, manipulating the statistics. And a lot of the issues that are raised in the book are now being discussed as part of the mayoral race. Quotas, downgrading of crime, civil rights violations, stop and frisk. These are all things that have been sort of a part of this mayoral race. My journey through this story began in March of 2010 when I got a cryptic email from the police officer. His name was H.M. Schoolcraft. It was just one paragraph, and then there was an audio file attached to it. I clicked on the audio file, and it was a sergeant telling the police officers not to take crime reports under certain circumstances, not to take robbery reports under certain circumstances. And that was amazing to me because reporters had always talked about this going on, but just to have a commander actually saying that on tape was amazing, you know. So I was intrigued, so I called him, and I said, can I come see you? And I was expecting to go to Brooklyn or Queens. Turns out he was in this tiny little town in upstate New York, North Baldwin. And so I drove up there, and the town was kind of run down. Kind of a rust belt town that used to manufacture leather products, but a lot of the factories had closed. And they were living Adrian was living in a nondescript, also kind of run-down apartment complex with his father in a one-bedroom apartment. And so I knocked on the door, and they let me in, and I didn't know what to expect. It turned out Adrian was a huge guy, but he was very kind of soft-spoken and reticent. You know, I expected, he looked like he could walk through a wall, but very soft-spoken and reticent. His father, on the other hand, was a much smaller guy, but very loud and very talkative, probably the most talkative person I've ever met. And before long, we started with Mayor Bloomberg and Ray Kelly, and we ended up talking about the JFK assassination and you know, various conspiracy theories. And then Adrian and I had to go in the other room to get him to stop talking because he had gone on for like 25 minutes. Adrian was living in his bedroom, which was completely undecorated. He just had a computer and a desk and a bed on a mattress on the floor. And I said, so how much tape do you have? And he goes, oh, about 1,200 hours. For a reporter, this is a big deal. So it turned out that he had been recording secretly in his precinct for 2 years. And the only way he could do this was because the digital recorder technology had gotten to the point where they were just about this big. And he had bought two or three of them. One of them was a watch recorder. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a watch recorder. It just looked like a normal watch, except it had a microphone on it. And the other one he just put in his shirt pocket and wore it. It turned it on at the beginning of his tour, and then turned it off at the end of the tour and went home and just downloaded it onto his computer. And then, of course, he could pick out certain things that he thought were interesting. But a lot of it was just street chatter and locker room banter and stuff like that. It wasn't really useful. But what he did give me was the roll calls. The roll calls are the meetings at the beginning of each tour where police commanders tell the officers what to focus on for that day. So he gave me 117 roll calls. And so now I had a day-to-day record of exactly what the officers were being ordered to do, you know, over a long period of time. You could really get a sense of what the priorities were in the precinct. And the main priority was getting numbers. The police commander was absolutely obsessed with getting numbers, with getting higher summonses, higher stop and frisks, and lower crime numbers. And there was this constant drumbeat every day in the roll calls, get more summonses, and to the point where the officers really had no discretion at all. I mean, there was a quota was the main thing, just get your numbers. This again is a product of Comstock. You know, it started in the early 90s under Commissioner Bratton, and it was very successful in driving down crime. But as time went on, it became harder and harder to drive crime down by the same percentages that it had in the beginning, right? And at the same time, success in Comstock for precinct commanders meant promotion. So those two things combined to create an incredible incentive for police commanders to come up with innovative, quote unquote, innovative ways to make their numbers look better. So some of the things they would do is have what was directed summons units, where you just go to a corner and you write every summons you could find, no matter what, just everything. Instead of, you know, in the past, cops had the discretion to say, all right, I'm just going to let you off with a warning. But now, because they had to get their numbers, that kind of discretion was gone. Adrian came from Texas. He's actually a registered Republican, which a lot of people find surprising, given what he did. His dad was a police officer. So he was really an outsider in terms of the police department culture. He didn't grow up in Bay Ridge or in Jamaica or in the South Bronx. He was from the outside, so he didn't really have any ties here. He also didn't really even want to become a police officer. He had been in the Navy as a corpsman, and he had got out and he worked for Motorola in Texas on on software chips, and only moved back to New York because his mother got sick. And she was very sick, and she said to him, she saw an ad for a police department, for a police recruiting ad. This is after 9/11. And she said, well, why don't you try to apply to be a police officer? And he said, oh, I don't want to do that. And then she finally convinced him, and he took the test, and he did very well, and they called him immediately. And he ended up, he found himself standing there in the police academy. And for the first couple of years, he went along with the program. The first thing you do as a police officer is you go into something called IMPACT, where you're sent to a high crime precinct as a rookie and just for about 8 months and just told to write tickets. And you're not really given a lot of supervision. And because you're a rookie officer, they can fire you for everything. So the rookies are basically obligated to do exactly as they're told or else they're going to get fired. So after that, you went to the 81st precinct in Bed-Stuy, which coincidentally is the precinct where Frank Serpico started his career, if anyone remembers who Frank Serpico is. He was the central figure in a major corruption, in uncovering major corruption in the police department in the early 70s. So for those first couple of years, Adrian, went along with the program, got his quotas. They called him the Hammer. He was so rough because he's about 6'2", 230 pounds. He's a big guy. But as time went on, he became discontented, disenchanted with this constant quota pressure, and started objecting. And Adrian is one of these people who likes to write letters. So he was objecting to the amount of overtime he was getting, and he wrote a notarized letter to his police commander. Of course, that didn't go anywhere. It was pretty much ignored, but it just gives you a sense of who he was. He's like, well, I'm going to write a letter about this. This is outrageous. And there were a couple of other things that he complained about. his first precinct commander was actually tolerant of Adrian because Adrian was smart and he was out on the street and he was trying to do his job. But he left, and the next commander came in, a guy named Stephen Moriello. And Moriello was very much a combat commander. He was interested in the numbers. It was all about numbers. It wasn't about discretion or community policing. It was about getting the numbers, make the precinct look good, make himself look good. And the whole atmosphere changed when he came in. And Adrian immediately became a target because they were looking at their spreadsheets and they were saying, well, so-and-so has 30 summonses for the month and you only have 3. Why is that? So-and-so has 18 stop and frisks and you only have 6. Well, and Adrian said, well, I'm not doing my job. I'm just seeing what's happening and responding to it. There's a wonderful exchange between the XO, the executive officer in the precinct, and Adrian over these two conflicting theories of policing. Adrian's theories, I'm going to respond to the crimes that I see, I'm going to respond to the misconduct that I see, but I'm not going to get a number just for the number's sake. And the executive officer is saying, you're going to get the numbers or else we're going to find out some way to get rid of you, you're going to get transferred, you're going to get... So they identified him as a problem and they started squeezing him. And by squeezing him, I mean they started giving him bad assignments. They took him out of the car and put him on a footpost in one of the most dangerous areas in the precinct by himself for the night shift. The night shift is 3:30 to 11:30. There are 3 shifts in the typical day in the police department. They would send him out of the precinct all the time to stand on a corner in Midtown Manhattan. One of the big problems with the police department right now, and it has been for years, is that the numbers are way down, and at the same time, cops are being pulled out of precincts mostly in the outer boroughs and put into high tourist areas like Midtown Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, around Ground Zero, police headquarters, City Hall. And the effect of that, of course, you can see why they're doing it, to make sure nothing happens to embarrass the city in these tourist-heavy areas, but the effect of it is that the outer borough precincts are often badly short-staffed, And there's stuff in the book about that. You know, at one point there's only one car for the whole, for like half the precinct, such a car for half the precinct. He starts objecting, they start squeezing him, giving bad assignments. He starts taping because he's concerned and he wants to build evidence of what's going on in the precinct, and he also wants to protect himself. So he goes out, he does this in consultation with his father. His father is a real driving force. You'll see it in the book. He's like behind the scenes kind of egging him on to do this stuff. And Adrian has this very strong sense of right and wrong. So he thinks if he builds evidence with his tape recording, you know, he'll be able to protect himself. So things get worse and worse. And I just want to read you some of the, just a few quotes from the tapes, which I think are really interesting, really kind of an interesting and amusing at the same time. There's one point where a sergeant in one of the roll calls says, "Listen, this isn't Manhattan where everyone's walking around smiling and being happy. This is Bed-Stuy where everyone probably has a warrant." So it gives you a sense that, you know, that's the perception of, you know, can you imagine, you know, if the perception of the community is that, you know, you can imagine what the relationship is like between the patient and the community. There's another quote. Adrian is talking with another officer who's telling him a story about how the precinct commander downgraded this one particular crime. A guy had reported a stolen car, and the precinct commander responded to the scene, which is unusual and also telling. He was so obsessed with getting his crime numbers down that he was responding to individual crime scenes to check on the reports. And that's unheard of. You know, that's something that would never have happened 15, 20 years ago unless it was a very major crime. This is a routine stolen car report. The precinct commander responded, and he's talking to the guy, and he said, have you been in prison at all? And the guy goes, yeah, well, when I was young, I did a couple of years. And the precinct commander says, well, maybe karma stole your car, meaning that he was getting paid back. That report ended up not being taken. The guy tried, and so there's an example. The guy tried to report a crime, and it ended up just going down into the circular file. There was another incident where a woman had her cell phone robbed on the subway, and the commander responded again, and he told her, well, what do you want me to do about it? You're not going to get it back. I mean, I don't know. You want me to drive you home? You know. So that report also got taken. And you know, these aren't homicides. You know, these are routine low level incidences. But those are the kinds of incidents that cops respond to most. You know, so I mean, if it's happening like that in one precinct, you know, yeah, it's logical to guess that it's happening in other precincts, right? There's another roll call where the commander comes in. The commander would have these wonderful, like, long speeches about how important it was to keep the numbers down. And this time he's talking to Schoolcraft about his own numbers. It's in a meeting where they're trying to pressure Schoolcraft into getting his quotas. And he says, with these numbers, the chief will go through the roof. His head will come through the top of Wilson Avenue. Wilson Avenue is the borough headquarters. So the significance there is that here you have a chief in the New York City Police Department, which has over 30,000 officers, worried about one officer in one of the 10 precincts that he worried about the numbers of one officer in one of the 10 precincts that he oversees. And that gives you a sense of just how crazy this number-driven strategy got. That it was now that this chief, there's only about 30 chiefs in the department, worried about one of 30,000 officers and his number of summonses and the number of traffic tickets he read. And then there's a lot of great little kind of quotes or vignettes about what it's like to be a patrol officer, which is the lowest of all. And there's a sergeant who says, in one of the roll calls, he says, "Listen, if you're watching a dead guy's apartment, don't sit in his chair. Don't watch his TV. And don't eat his food out of the refrigerator. I think it's the same roll call where he's talking about how the officers were defacing the precinct for graffiti, which I thought was funny, given the amount of resources the department puts into eradicating graffiti outside the precinct. So Adrian finally decides he can't go anywhere with his, inside the precinct. No one's going to listen to him. So he goes to this investigative unit called the Quality Assurance Division with allegations and documentation of downgrading of crimes and refusing it. Cops refusing to take crime reports. And they sit for 2 hours, and they promise to investigate it. And after that, Adrian starts getting calls from the Internal Affairs Bureau at the precinct. The Internal Affairs Bureau is leaving messages for him at the precinct, which is kind of like telling the precinct commander that he's gone to investigate it about what's going on in the precinct. It's a huge breach, and to this day, I'm not sure why he did it. I think it was incredibly stupid, but... 3 weeks after he went to the investigators, and this is Halloween 2009, he's feeling intimidated by one of his lieutenants, because his lieutenant has found his memo book, and Adrian has been keeping notes in his memo book about the misconduct in the precinct. And so the lieutenant takes the memo book, copies it, and then comes out and starts walking around Adrian in a threatening manner. And so Adrian goes home an hour early, goes home sick. When he gets home, he calls Internal Affairs and makes a complaint. And they do this with take it, but it's clear that nothing's going to happen from it. That night, in the meantime, there's some kind of controversy at the precinct about Adrian leaving early. So that night, they go to his house, and they send emergency services, which is the heavily armed kind of SWAT unit in the police department, and the deputy chief goes, who's one of the most senior people in the department, the precinct commander, the executive officer, and a whole bunch of other people. They go to his house, and they say, listen, you left early, you got to come back to the precinct. And Adrian's kind of stubborn, and he says, you're in my apartment. They get into his apartment by getting a key from the landlord, and his apartment is like about the size of this platform. You know, so you can imagine, you have 12 police officers, a lot of them heavy-duty tactical gear, standing in this tiny space. It's kind of intimidating. And he says, but Adrian says, as stubborn as he is, he says, I'm not going. So the chief comes in, the chief gets angry, and says, you're not going, you're refusing an order from the deputy chief in the police department. And Adrian says, no, I'm not going. All of a sudden, Adrian becomes an EDP. EDP is department acronym for emotionally disturbed person. It's basically saying he's crazy. And once you identify somebody as an EDP, you basically can take them to the hospital and force them to go to the hospital. They lose their rights. So they've gotten into the apartment without a warrant. There's no crime. Now they've labeled him as crazy. And now he's basically surrendered his civil rights. He refuses to go with them. They throw him on the floor. They put a foot in his chest. They rough him up. And in the book, this whole sequence is in there in much more detail. Then they put him in a chair and like basically strap him down and take him to the Jamaica Hospital Psychiatric Ward. Now, the department says this is fully justified. However, Adrian recorded the whole thing. And it's completely unjustified. I mean, he's basically calm throughout. He doesn't raise his voice until the point where they tackle him and throw him off the bed. I mean, you would too if you were being tackled and thrown off of the bed. He's basically in control. He's just saying, look, if you guys want me to come back, I'm not coming back to the precinct today. I'll come back tomorrow. You can discipline me for leaving work early, and that's it. Right? But they wouldn't let it go, and this is where it all kind of comes together. Why would they do that? They knew that he had gone to investigators. They knew that he had this evidence. Why would they push it so hard? You know, if you know, if I go home from work early without telling my boss, he's going to call me up and yell at me, and that's going to be it. You know, they pushed to the point where he was taken off to the psych ward. So he's sitting in the psych ward and he's watching TV. There's a woman who keeps repeatedly forcing herself to violence sitting next to him. He's watching TV, and all of a sudden, Greg Kelly comes on. Greg Kelly is the police commissioner's son, who has a morning show on Fox. And Greg Kelly is talking about beating a parking ticket. So here's a teenager in school craft, a police officer, sitting in the sidewalk for no reason, watching police commissioner's son talking about beating a parking ticket. But that was wonderful. Meanwhile, his father is calling everyone he can to try to get him out of the psych ward. He calls the FBI, he calls the mayor's office, he calls the police commissioner's office, he calls internal affairs, etc. He can't get anyone, no one listens. And that's another piece of the story that's amazing, is that the oversight agencies, all of the oversight agencies ignore this whole thing, the civil rights violations, the things that he was talking about. It's enough to make you really cynical about the whole process. I mean, you know, all right, so he finally gets out, and he starts talking to the press a little bit. Larry and his father flee up to that small apartment in upstate New York and hole up in there, like two fugitives, even though they're not. And the department starts sending people outside the city up there to bang on their door to get them to come out. And so what takes place is this cat and mouse game where Adrian and Larry are sitting inside the apartment going, I don't know what to do. What should we do? Should we open the door? I don't know. And the cops are outside going, bam, 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 bam. You know, there's one just where the guy knocked, and I counted it. He knocks 186 times on the door to get him, and he's pounding on the door, and he's saying, Adrian, come out. We want to talk to you. So then the department sends us surveillance SUVs, these black SUVs that are basically doing surveillance, and so you have this hilarious thing where Adrian and Larry are like peeking out the curtains, and these two surveillance SUVs sitting in the truck. Just remember, there's no crime being committed here. The police officers are completely outside this jurisdiction, right? And they're just sitting there surveilling a guy, basically a wayward police officer who's, you know, maybe a little bit eccentric. So I was able, for this book, I was able to obtain the notes of that surveillance. And I just wanted to read a couple of sentences. In the meantime, they're videotaping the house, okay? They're videotaping everything. They're recording it. You know, these are lieutenants and sergeants who are making over $100,000 a year doing it, sitting up there all day. One of the notes is, light from possible fish tank has been turned on. Another is, sergeant utilized binoculars. Subject appeared to be wearing a white T-shirt and what appeared to be gray sweatpants. That was the best they could do. Eventually the police realized that Aiden was going to cooperate, and they kind of backed off. That took 2 months. And then another thing they did after that was they conducted this investigation, and they did everything they could to discredit him, including when he tried to apply for food stamps, they blocked his application because they said he was still technically a police officer even though he wasn't being paid. I thought that was a really vindictive thing to do. And then they produced the internal reports, which are in the book, which have never been written about or seen, which I was able to get, in which they completely ignore the tape recording of Halloween night. They ignore all of the documentary evidence that they have, and they just believe what the police officers, what the police bosses said. There's a tape that has the entire incident documented, and these internal affairs reports just completely ignore them, and reject all of Schoolcraft's allegations and believe what the commander says. It's amazing. But the one thing that was going in his favor was the Quality Assurance Division, the unit that he went to. They actually did their jobs, and they were able to show that Adrian was telling the truth, that he was right about downgrading. They checked out every one of his every one of the cases that he brought to them. He brought 13 cases, and they were able to substantiate every one of them. That report was completed in June of 2010. The department put it into a safe and locked the safe, and it didn't see the light of day, and wouldn't have seen the light of day if I hadn't been able to get it through a source 18 months after it was finished. And during that 18 months, I had been asking for this report, and the department kept saying, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't know what the report's not done. I kept getting stonewalled, and it was clear that they just didn't want to release it because it confirmed a lot of what Adrian was saying. So he had gone to the oversight agency, he wanted to do anything. The only thing he had left to do was sue, and that's where it is now. It's so 3 years, or 2.5 years, he filed a lawsuit in 2010, in August, and basically it's been legal wrangling since. And I go into that, and that's very interesting, also about sort of the strategy that the city took in this case, and what happened with Adrian and his lawyers and his father, and the incredible stress and tension that comes when you're trying to fight. I mean, remember, these are little guys. They're just a father and son. They don't have any money. They've basically been living hand to mouth for 3 years, and they're fighting against a $4 billion law enforcement agency with unlimited legal resources. You know, with the commissioner is probably the most prominent law enforcement official in the country. And there's a billionaire mayor, and they're worried about their legacies. And here's the little Adrian Schoolcraft saying, giving a completely different narrative to the last, you know, the last 8 years in the police department. I just wanted to mention, you know, Adrian's work has been very significant. Not in terms of him getting people indicted for how he's treated, but in terms of affecting the dialogue in the city. And the best example of that is that his tapes were played in the landmark stop and frisk trials, Floyd versus New York, Floyd versus City of New York. And the judge in that case described the case as smoking gun evidence of civil rights violations. I'm told that there's going to be a decision on that case this week, which might result, for the first time in memory, a federal monitor being appointed over to oversee the police department. And that would be a historic thing. So in that respect, he's had some success. Just a couple things. Other characters in the book. There's another cop in the book named Adil Polanco who went through a very similar thing in the Bronx. And Adil was one of these guys that he grew up in Washington Heights during a period when Washington Heights was a very dangerous neighborhood. And was able to get through that and became an officer. And then saw his career kind of crash up on the shoals of this numbers-driven strategy. You know, at some point he got sick of stopping and frisking young black and Hispanic men for no reason. You know, he just started objecting to that, and they squeezed him just like they squeezed Adrian. And also in the book, there's a detective first grade, Harold Hernandez, who 8 years ago, I'll just tell the story really quickly, that a guy gets arrested for a attempted knife point rape in an apartment. And Hernandez comes in the morning and sits with him in the interview room, and he looks at him and says, "You've done this before, haven't you?" And the guy says, "Yeah." And eventually he shows him the locations. And it turns out that he'd done six previous attempted knife point rapes, but they had all been classified as misdemeanors. So the sex crimes unit was never notified. The precinct commander at the time wanted so badly to keep his numbers down, that these very serious crimes were downgraded to misdemeanors, and thus a rapist was able to continue to work with impunity for a period of months, and he attacked. You know, I talked once to one of his victims, and she said that for the next 3 years after that, she would never, she could never relax in a hallway or a vestibule or an elevator. You know, and she actually left the city and lives in a small town now. So that's kind of the real world effect of this downgrading of content through feeding tape reports. That's all I have. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, sir.
Some sunny day. blue skies drive the dark clouds.